Hi, I'm Ken McLeod. We have designed and continue to refine unfetteredmind.org to make it easy for you to access our podcasts, translations, articles, and transcripts. But websites cost money to maintain and update. Our free content is only possible because people like you make donations. So if you find our materials helpful, please go to unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path, Part 12.
Monday, September? August 31st, morning session, A Trackless Path. Last night, I asked you to consider, those of you who've come recently, the question, why am I here? And I encourage you not to answer this intellectually, but to listen to all the different forms of knowing in our body, guts, heart, mind, spirit, so forth and so forth. There's also another way to work with such questions, which some of you may find helpful. And it's a technique known as the five whys. Whys, W-H-Y. Why am I here? Well, I want to get enlightened. Okay? Why do I want to get enlightened? And you just keep asking why. Now, you'll find usually that around the third or fourth why, things start to get a little difficult. And often what is happening around that point is that you're beginning to move from conceptual or intellectual answers into the level of feeling or emotion. And you may very well, around third, fourth, or fifth, hit a feeling which you can experience, but there may not be any words for it. That's fine. Rest right there. Even though it's not formulated in words, that's why you're here. And this goes to a phrase that I've used very often, borrowing from my friend and colleague Stephen Batchelor, in its institutional forms, Buddhism provides very powerful answers to questions of the spirit. But sometimes the power of the answers overwhelms the stammering voice which is asking the questions. And we make a huge assumption, and I think a completely unwarranted assumption, when we suppose that that spiritual practice is about the same thing for everyone. More and more, I see this, and I'll talk about this more this evening and later on, that what we're doing here is finding a way, each of us individually, for our lives to evolve in a direction which we may be able to feel or sense, but we may not yet know. and what that direction is and how that evolution takes place in terms of what practices we do and so forth. Increasingly, I've come to see as a very individual matter. In the Tibetan tradition, certainly, and in most other Buddhist traditions, we have the notion of the path. One of the books that I translated in English was titled The Great Path of Awakening. And I've increasingly found it interesting to replace the article the with the article a. So it is a path. And I wonder what that book would look like if it had been titled A Great Path of Awakening. People would have looked at, oh, that's just a great path. I want the great path. So, and again, this is part of the reason for the structure of this retreat, which I described last night, how that it's very open. It's rather than me being the teacher, what I'm seeking to do here is to create an environment in which you can learn about your path and find ways that that path can evolve in your life, or your life can evolve in that path, whichever way you want to put it. And the interviews that we have each day are primarily about helping you get clearer about how things are evolving or opening or moving in you, not so much about you following a prescribed course of practice or discipline or something like that. Now, discipline and all of those things are required, but they are not prescribed. They come through your commitment to your path, and then you find certain ways of behaving, certain ways of practice helpful in that. Last, and this is what people find. They experiment and say, well, if I do this, maybe this feels good, and they realize, no, that doesn't really work. And so of their own volition, they let go of that, rather than being told, no, that's not a good thing to do. It's a very, very different way. So what I'm hoping is that here you will learn, and in that context, my role here is as a resource in your learning. Any questions that any of you'd like to take up, or comments? Okay. Thanks, Leslie. This evening I'd like to start with any questions any of you have about practice, of course, about anything in the support booklet, or even more general questions you may have. Larry, microphone should be behind you. Microphone. Ah, the tinkle of little bells.
I'm looking at page 12 and the last full paragraph. Kalu Rinpoche, is talking about a set of practices, and I wonder, based upon your experience with him, if you could kind of talk about that set of practices, because in a sense, I mean, this is called the essence of the Dharma, and these practices impressed me for their simplicity.
So the paragraph that Larry is referring to, at the bottom of page 12 in Kala Rinpoche's Essence of the Dharma, first repeat refuge many times, then generate awakening mind, the intention to work at Dharma to bring all sentient beings to full awakening. Cultivate being Avalokiteshvara, an empty appearance like a rainbow. Recite the six syllables many times. Nothing is more helpful than this. Continuously pray to your guru and dedicate all virtue to the awakening of all beings. Right? I thought I was just going to get away with answering questions this evening instead of giving a talk. Thanks, Larry. Okay. I'm going to do this in two parts. In the Tibetan tradition, and I don't know whether this goes back to the Indian tradition of Buddhism, but I suspect it does, there is a general framework for formal practice sessions. By formal practice sessions, I mean where you're practicing one or other forms of meditation, or you might be doing rituals or other or ceremonies, things, but they were unmixed with other activities. And the framework is described as the three seals. At least I think I have the correct translation there. The seal of preparation, which is refuge and awakening mind, or bodhicitta. Jorwa, Chamdra Samche, Nguji. The main, a seal of the main practice, which is usually translated as non-conceptualization, but could also be translated as no reference. And then the seal of conclusion, which is dedication. Now, if we turn to page 4, we've been doing this daily, you'll see that there are two short prayers that we've been doing, the refuge and awakening intention. Now, the refuge is about setting a direction. And the image is one derived very much from feudal times, or one of the explanations, one of the metaphors is derived very much from feudal times, in which the peasants would seek refuge in the local warlord with his castle. So that when other when armies and other problems, famines, things like that, came up, they were under his protection. And the idea being that what provides you protection from the vicissitudes of samsara? And the answer is the three jewels, in its most common form, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Now, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three jewels, can be interpreted on many, many levels. And Robert, can I borrow your copy of Wake Up to Your Life, please? I keep telling you everything's in here. And I'm become more and more convinced that whoever wrote this should be shot. Page 43 in Wake Up to Your Life. You'll find a discussion of the three jewels and the three and refuge. Page, top of page 46. To take refuge in the Buddha is to rest in the emptiness of original mind, free from any reference or defining characteristic. To take refuge in the Dharma is to experience the clarity of original mind, the natural awareness that knows what experience is and how experience arises. To take refuge in the Sangha is to be one with the unimpeded arising and subsiding of experience. That should be now unrestricted arising and subsiding of experience, free from the three poisons of attraction, aversion, and indifference. Thanks. And that's really what refuge is about. And as I said, it's about setting a direction. And so the way one prepared for a period of formal practice is you set a direction, or you set this direction. Now you'll see here that I've added a few other lines, and I discussed this in about a week ago, but it won't hurt to repeat it now. In the Tibetan tradition, and probably in the middle and later Indian traditions, there's some formulas for refuge which included the teacher, the guru. One has Tilopa's famous statement to his main student, Naropa, without a guru, the thousand Buddhas of the Kalpa don't appear. And one can view this in a number of ways, either as a degeneration, or, as I prefer to, as a movement, the beginning of a movement into a less mythical approach to practice, in that most of us our practice becomes substantial and takes on, well, be a little redundant here, takes on substance only when we find a person who can actually guide us. And not always, but in many cases one forms a quite intimate emotional connection with that person. They become a very important part of one's life. And when you have the phrase, I take refuge in my teacher, treasured Buddha, it's not because this person is a Buddha. It's because this person holds the possibility of awakening, or that door for you. And there's a slight digression here. We've lost, to a very great extent, the ability to express and understand things in poetic and mythic terms. I was having a discussion on this topic with a psychologist probably 7 or 8 years ago. And he said, "What are you talking about, Ken?" I said, "Well, in Tibetan Buddhism, you regard your teacher as Buddha." And he immediately said, "Oh, so he's infallible." I said, "Well, that's exactly the point. That's exactly what we do as Westerners. That's an instance of how we've lost the ability to express and understand things in mythic terms." Express and understand things in mythic terms. Because when we say, "My teacher is Buddha," we're not saying he is an infallible human being, or he's perfect, or she's this, or whatever. We're really describing our relationship with that person. And that's a very different thing. And we use this kind of symbolic language to express that very special quality. Not a friend in the ordinary sense. If they're opposite sex, it's not a lover, even though the connection can be very close emotionally and of extraordinary intimacy. But it's where we experience what being awake means. And thank you, Jean. So that's a natural way we can help set, or something in our lives that helps set direction. So that's why I take refuge in my teacher, treasured Buddha. It's okay. That kind of this is, for some reason, this person is able to meet and respond to my deepest spiritual questions. You with me, Larry?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Then the third line here, three sources, guru, deity, and protector. This is a reference to Vajrayana practice. And in this context, the guru, again, it's highly mythic language. The guru represents energy. The energy of inspiration, the energy of attention. It's not something that is easily put into words. People consistently take me to task for using the word energy here. They prefer the more classical translation of blessing. I don't like blessing because the origin of that term is the sprinkling of blood and from animal sacrifice, with the idea of making something sacred. There is a kind of connection there, but I prefer to make it more explicit, even if it is a bit less poetic. Deity refers to Yidam, and we'll be saying more about that in a minute. This really represents capacity and ability. Capacity and ability. Yes. So, to take a couple of examples. Avalokiteshvara, which we'll be discussing more, is awakened compassion. So it's the capacity and the ability to experience oneself and potentially one's world as the expression of awakened compassion, which leads one to live life somewhat differently. Protector is a little more difficult. The classical definition of protector is expressions of awakened mind which create conditions conducive to practice and remove conditions which are not conducive to practice. And everybody says, oh, that sounds good. But suppose you've been very successful in your career and you've become completely enthralled with the comfort and opportunities that income and honors and fame provide you. Well, if you're swept away by that completely, this is not exactly conducive to practice. So there is the possibility that the protectors manifest to make life a little more difficult. It's usually not appreciated. Now, microphone, please.
Can you give an example of a protector? I mean, iconographically.
Oh, sure. Mahakala. Sri Devi, Padma Lamo. In the... yeah, there's several different forms of Mahakala. The two-armed, four-armed, six-armed. White, red, green, blue, yellow. There's... I mean, there are hundreds of them. Okay. But really, this is where it gets a little frightening. You come into a situation, you see it, you see what needs to be done, and you do it without thinking. That's how the protector manifests. And it's non-conceptual expression of presence. And the rational mind is way slower and often has a lot of problems with it. One of the presentations the other day was pointing to that. If you know which one I'm talking about, Leah. The being shot. Okay? So, these are a much more internal refuge. And then the last line, I make these empty, clear, and without restriction quite explicit. So all of this is about setting direction. This is the direction I'm going in my practice. Open to the possibilities that the teacher presents to me, this framework of teacher instruction and support is embodied in the three jewels. More internally, developing the energy, the capacity and abilities, and the and being prepared to do whatever needs to be done in order to know experience to be empty, clear, without restriction. Then the second part of the preparation is awakening mind. In the Tibetan tradition, most of the verses or expressions of awakening mind say something along the lines, in order that all sentient beings may, or that I may place all sentient beings in full awakening, I'm undertaking this practice. Or it may also be expressed in the form of, just as awakened ones before me have traveled this path, I now follow in their footsteps and go through the same kind of training. The first of those is, again, an example of mythic expression, which has largely been taken literally, and with a number of attendant problems. We have this whole myth of the Bodhisattva who holds back enlightenment until every last sentient being is taken. Well, that's actually one of three different kinds of awakening mind. It's the king-like awakening mind, which you lead everybody to awakening. And then there's the ferryman awakened mind, which awakened mind, which you carry everybody with you across the river. And then there's a shepherd awakening mind, in which you make sure all the sheep are safe before you go to bed at night. But these are all metaphors for a certain attitude that is basically an expression of compassion. But awakening mind isn't simply about compassion. Awakening mind has this awakened quality to it. So, in the prayers we're using here, I stole, if you wish, or borrowed, made use of, a very different formulation of awakening intention. This is from the Zen tradition. I don't know whether it goes back to the Chinese tradition of Chan, but these are known as the Four Great Vows. But they usually appear in somewhat different translation, and I, after studying this quite carefully, I decided didn't like those translations, so I, knowing no Japanese, I had the temerity to translate it this way, or render it this way. And if you see, there's a progression here. Beings are numberless, may I free them all. Well, that's the conventional way that bodhicitta is expressed. I'm going to work for the benefit of infinite sentient beings. But if we take a closer look at how, say, I experience things, what is a sentient being to me? Well, it's a certain experience. What's the problem with a sentient being for me? Well, not only do they suffer, they stimulate reactive emotions in me. If they didn't stimulate reactive emotions in me, I wouldn't have any problem, right? But they do. They trigger that stuff. So that's the second line. Reactions are endless. May I release them all? Now, this pretty well everyone here, I think, knows. When you really experience a reactive emotion, you discover it's a door into a different way of experiencing things. So that's the third line. And when you go through that door, you usually experience some kind of awakening. It's like, oh. And that's the fourth line. So beings are numberless, may I free them all. Reactions are endless, may I release them all. Which then becomes doors to experience are infinite, may I enter them all. And that becomes ways of awakening are limitless, may I know them all. Now, whereas refuge is setting direction, Awakening mind is setting intention. So here it is a question of working with everything life throws at you. I have to underline one word in that. Everything. Many years ago, back in the early 90s, I found myself in a situation which I wanted to go in a certain direction, but there were some potential ethical problems with it. And that I was really torn. And I kept mulling it over. And one morning it just became clear to me that one of the implicit facets of this intention to awaken, it's not usually voiced explicitly, or is you don't get to indulge your own confusion. Ever. You don't get to indulge your own confusion. Ever. That's beginning to bite pretty deeply.
What would that look like?
Well, Pat, you have an all too many, right? Hand the microphone over to Pat. You want to give an example of this?
Not getting to indulge your own confusion?
Is that
what you're referring to?
Can you give an example?
To me, indulging your own confusion is anytime you stop and say, poor me.
Well, that's one aspect of it, yeah.
Or, I can't handle it. Or, this is too much.
No, I think those are all examples. Thank you. Yes. I'm going to give maybe a more explicit one for Larry here. Something comes up in your life and it's the answer to one of your forgotten dreams. Okay? So, it really hits your heart. Maybe a person, it may be a job opportunity, I mean, it could be anything. And you're drawn to it naturally. But there's it's going to involve you abrogating some fairly significant commitments or responsibilities. Yeah. In your life and in the life of others. What do you do? And it may be that this something like this entices you so much that you can't really see that it's you're in your dream rather than the real world. I had a horrible case of this with a client many, many years ago. Someone I was encouraging him to take initiative and step out of his box. Bad, bad advice. So he was married. He came, next meeting I had with him, he was telling me how he was cashing in his IRA in order to elope with his massage therapist. And so I managed to keep a straight face, and then I asked him about five questions.
because he really hadn't thought through the implications. And by the end of those five questions, his face was a rather interesting shade of green. So, managed to, fortunately nothing had happened, which was irrevocable. So, there was a person who was stepping right into indulging his own confusion. Okay? Is that clear enough? Oh, yeah. Okay. So, the commitment in the Bodhisattva vow, although it is generally expressed in terms of working for the benefit of all sentient beings, it's really about being completely clear in your experience. And that's why I like this particular formulation, because it points not only to that aspect of the Bodhisattva vow, it actually describes how it happens. And one of the reasons we're here practicing together is developing the skills and the ability and the capacity in order to be completely clear in our experience. And so that's why I say this is very much about intention. Okay? So now we come to the next part, going back to page 12. Cultivate being Avalokiteshvara in empty appearance like a rainbow. Now, in classical Tibetan Buddhism, this meant that you imagined that you were Avalokiteshvara. What Rinpoche is thinking of here is the four-armed form, which was Rinpoche's favorite practice and the favorite practice of many, many other teachers, because it's simple, it does all the work, etc. So you imagine you are this deity in this white form with one face, four arms, and all the accoutrements, who is the embodiment of awakened compassion. And this form that you're imagining isn't substantial, it's like light, like a rainbow. And by moving into this again and again, you begin to create the possibility of experiencing things another way, as not being a substantial fluid. In order to refresh the mind, in order to provide a way of quieting the mind, you recite the six-syllable mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Now, let me say a word about mantra practice first. The power of mantra comes from constant repetition. And if you're practicing mantra, you say it all the time. Mantra is sometimes described, or it's explained in terms of a folk etymology, that is what protects the mind. The way it protects the mind is that by reciting the mantra all the time, it becomes such a habit that it replaces the undercurrent of thinking that's always going on. Now, many of you know in your meditation, you can sit and you sit very quietly, but there's this little, like, the very old long-distance calls, you could hear something in the background. Maybe you sometimes do on cell calls now. You can't quite make it out, but there's this, like, this conversation just below the surface. Trungpa had a wonderful term for this, subconscious gossip. So you say the mantra so much that the mantra replaces the subconscious gossip. And now you have a quiet mind. It's exactly the same in the centering prayer in the Orthodox tradition. Lord Jesus, have mercy upon me, a sinner. You do exactly the same. That's the first step in using that prayer, is that you repeat it over and over again all the time until it's replaced the subconscious gossip. So this is a very, very old use. Mantra is also used to refresh the mind, so that when you're doing formal deity practice, you know, you're doing this visualization and you run out of juice and just can't do it anymore. So then you just say the mantra and let the mind rest. Because you're saying the mantra, you're protecting the mind from distractions and disturbances. So it's also used to refresh the mind. And there are other uses, but those are the two principal ones. And the six syllables was highly regarded because it's very easy, short, easy to remember, and it has been endowed with a huge amount of symbolism. There's a book called the Manikambam, which was written in the 8th, 9th century, which is called Manikambam, means the 100,000 instructions in reference to this mantra. It's this thick, and it just goes through all of the different symbolisms that have been associated with this mantra.
When it's being transmitted,
microphone.
Just a second. When that mantra is being transmitted as a technique from a guru to a student, does the guru choose one of these 108,000 different forms?
Oh, no, no mention is made. Very little. No. You just recite the mantra in the presence of the guru. That's the transmission. The way that... So now going back to cultivate being Avalokiteshvara in empty appearance. This is traditional Iram practice, in which you imagine yourself in this form, and the form is highly symbolic. So by acquainting yourself and just spending all of this time with the symbolic representation of awakened compassion, it soaks into you. So there you are, and you have forearms, and at some point they become alive because you realize that the forearms of compassion are the four immeasurables: equanimity, loving kindness, joy, and compassion. And so it becomes a very alive, vivid experience for you, and you're experiencing yourself as a symbol of awaken compassion, not substantial in the ordinary sense, and just awakens all of these possibilities for you. The way that I now approach that is actually very, very different. And it's part of the reason why I translated this as cultivate being Avalokiteshvara rather than meditating on Avalokiteshvara. What I prefer to do, because I think it's more in keeping with our culture, is rather than giving people the form, I will simply ask them, imagine you are the embodiment of awakened compassion. That's who and what you are. How is that for you? And, well, there are parts of us, of course, that say, oh, this is nice. And there are other parts that say, I don't think so. This isn't going to work for me. So by sitting with that very deeply, you get a sense of what goes on in you that prevents you from being the embodiment of awakened compassion. And now you start working out a whole relationship with that. And to, just to help things along, I like to give people, like, and I encourage people to take concrete scenarios. So one of my favorite is you have a very nice apartment or home, and there's a very good Persian rug in it. You've hired a contractor to come and repaint that room, and he spills paint on the Persian rug. You're the embodiment of awakened compassion. What do you do? Yeah, so it, okay, what does it actually look like in real life? You know, you're a teacher. You have background in education, right? So you're the embodiment of awakened compassion. You have an at-risk kid who's very bright, has a lot of potential. You've been cultivating, and you discover that he's cheated in a minor way on a test. What do you do? Or maybe cheated in a major way on a test. What do you do? So you can make up all of these things, but it's real life situations. You know, your least favorite in-laws are coming to stay with you for a week, or phone you up and tell you that they're coming to stay with you for a week. What do you do? So forth. And in this way, you begin to develop a. Okay, what does this actually mean? And I will usually have people do that for anywhere from 2 to 6 months, just living this. This is what they do in their practice, is really feel what this is like. And when they get a real sense of what it is, then I may start feeding them the symbolism and the form and so forth, so they get those other aspects. But very often, within they do this. They're beginning to, the way they're beginning to relate to their lives is changing substantially, which is really what this is about. So, cultivate being Avalokiteshvara, an empty appearance like a rainbow. Recite the six syllables. Nothing is more helpful than this, because when you do it this way, you're cultivating compassion, and in the process of cultivating compassion, you have to become open to how the world is. Everything is fluid, nothing is actually substantial, etc. So this is the emptiness component. And everything that is really essential in Mahayana Buddhist practice is right there. So this is the main practice, no reference. Just letting go, and you do this, letting go of your conceptual mind, letting go of the usual references, and just immersing yourself in relating to experience this way. Of course, if you're Avalokiteshvara and you have these little parts, if you're embodiment of awakened compassion, you have these little parts that are having a little rebellion, what do you do then if you're the embodiment of awakened compassion? How do you relate to those parts of you? You get the picture? And then move into continuously pray to your guru. This is to generate energy. You're transforming the energy of the emotional energy of devotion into the energy of attention. You generate sufficient emotional energy through devotion. You won't be able to think. And you can do the same with compassion, you can do the same with loving kindness. In the Tibetan tradition, the emphasis is on devotion, and you develop you pour your heart into that, and you find that you just can't think. Well, that's helpful. That's the result. Yep. You won't be able to think, and your mind is completely clear because of the emotional energy you're developing. And so the path of devotion opens directly into insight. And then the last part of this, dedicate all virtue to the awakening of all beings. This is the dedication. This is how you conclude practice, so that at the end of a practice session, instead of thinking, oh, what a good boy am I, and aren't I going to get a lot of good stuff out of this, and this is really good for me, and I'm not going to let anybody else in on this good stuff, which is all about identity and feeding oneself, you say, well, I've done this, may it work for the good of all. So you immediately dedicate. It's another renewal of that intention. Okay. The metaphor that, or the simile that's used here is that when you have a teaspoon of water just by itself, it quickly dries up in the sun. But if you tip it into the ocean, it's there for all time. Okay. So a follow-up question. Boy, you're selfish tonight, Larry. Go ahead.
These are just two things.
We'll see.
I'm sure they're brief.
It depends on my answer.
Why did Kalu Rinpoche choose a four-armed rather than a thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara? That's number one. And number two is, in terms of doing this visualization practice with a deity, it was my understanding that to embody the deity, there's required some kind of formal empowerments.
Oh boy, two quick questions, right? Well, you'll have to ask Kala Rinpoche. There are many forms of Avalokiteshvara. I don't know. A lot of different ones. Forearm form, for reasons I just don't have enough history to comment on this, became basically the patron saint of Tibet. Both the Dalai Lama and the Karmapa are both those incarnation lineages are regarded as expressions of Avalokiteshvara. And the forearm form is a lot easier to work with than the 13-headed, 1,000-arm form. But I don't know exactly why it became so powerful. The particular line of practice which Rinpoche taught came through visionary experience of a teacher called Tongtong Gyalpo. 16th, 17th century, I think. I've got his biography in my room, I just never learned his dates. Maybe George put it in the footnotes. He's so good at that kind of stuff. No, I don't see it here. But it was a very simple form of practice, and it's the one in here called Filling Space to Benefit Beings on page 24 and 25. And Rinpoche taught this very, very widely because as a way of providing a very simple practice which covered all the essential points. So that's the best I can offer on that one. Empowerments. Well, there are five forms of transmission. If I can remember them all. There's a direction, I'm not sure what a good translation for the next one is. I could just say a textual transmission, a permission, energy transmission, and empowerment. Most of what people receive from a teacher are permissions. They're relatively short ceremonies, which plant seeds of experience in the student. They don't really. To a certain extent, they plant seeds of experience, but they formally introduce the student to the practice. And literally, you're introduced to each aspect of the practice. The energy transmission and full empowerments are for the higher tantras. And those are much more elaborate ceremonies. With the respect to Avalokiteshvara, there are this form anyway. It's permission. And you can even practice it on the basis of a textual transmission, which is just a formal reading. So you hear the words of the text from a teacher. Now, Westerners make a big hullabaloo about empowerments. Go around collecting them like merit badges. And it's... that if you ask, you know, what is an empowerment, it's one way, it's the planting of seed of experience in the student. And that can happen in a formal ceremony, or it can happen in a casual encounter. So it can happen in many different ways.
What are the Tibetan names of these?
Ka, Lung, Jainong, Shinlap, and Wong. I can write those out for you if you want. Microphone, please.
And what you were just talking about, Ken, in terms of visualizing oneself as an embodiment of compassion, that really doesn't fall within any of these areas? Or does it? I'm just trying to get oriented to this world of empowerments, because one hears about them all the time. Like,
yeah,
but
I'm the worst person to orient you in that, because I'm not really in it.
Okay.
I mean, and I could put it into one of those categories, but I'm, for whatever reasons, I've decided to come at things in a very different direction. What I've tried to do in my teaching is really look at these traditional forms, and rather than just import the traditional forms into our culture, I try to ascertain what's really going on here, and then find a way to do something comparable in our culture to that. The reason I don't like to import the traditional forms without that kind of examination is that whenever you import something like that, you bring with it all of the assumptions, the ways of thinking, etc., etc., you bring a lot of stuff with it, which inevitably takes its own shape in new circumstances, and that's not always helpful. Okay, Nick, you had a question.
Yeah, on in the wisdom experience of ever-present good, on page 19.
Okay.
It's the last full stanza. Some use their ability to know movement as mind, to mull over the traces as thoughts and feelings ebb and flow, etc. So I've been looking at this since last year's retreat. What's going on? I don't understand. Like, so mulling over, I just don't understand that at all.
Okay. Some use their ability to know movement as mind, to mull over the traces as thoughts and feelings ebb and flow. People who track arising and fading in stable meditation just spin in confusion, even if they practice for 100 years. Sounds pretty serious, doesn't it?
What's the mistake there? I mean, I know that...
Okay. Dzogchen practice, as in Mahamudra, mind is awake, or as we could also think, your heart is awake. It's like, and you're just there, very clear, vivid experience, and you don't hold on to anything. Stuff comes, stuff goes. You may have heard the traditional analogies of like snowflakes lighting on a hot stone, or a knotted snake unties itself when you toss it in the air. Okay, so there's no holding. So what's happening here? There you are. You have a pretty good clarity in your meditation. So there you're sitting, and thinking or feeling arises. And you know it is thinking or feeling. You're not completely absorbed by the content. You with me? Okay? And then you say to yourself, that was an interesting one. I wonder where that came from. Okay? So even though you're not absorbed by the thinking, you still wonder about it. That's mulling over the traces. You follow? And then the next two lines, people who track arising and fading in stable meditation just spin in confusion. Because now I think, oh, my mind's getting brighter, oh, now it's getting clearer. And so there's this little bit of stepping back and a bit of commentary on what you're experiencing. In other words, you're not in that brilliantly clear, awake mind which is attaching to nothing. That's what they're talking about. Oh, that's what Jigme Lingpa is talking about here.
I had a feeling that I was guilty of that. So that's why I asked. Yeah.
Well, what's the punishment, Nick? If you're guilty, we have to do something.
Thanks.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Was there a question over here? Yes. JP.
Take a step back to the previous question a bit.
That's fine. We're just taking a relaxed evening.
Okay. In relation to empowerments and ceremonies.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah, that's where we're going.
Pardon?
I said, yes, that's where I'm going.
Yeah, I got it.
I have taken a formal refuge ceremony.
Yes.
And it felt like a commitment.
Yes.
In public, in front of people.
Yes.
Do you ever do ceremonies such as that? I'm just curious. Like Bodhisattva vow, for example.
Oh, dear.
I say it every day in my prayers.
Yeah, yeah. No. You don't know what you're stepping into here. just to clarify, the refuge vow and the Bodhisattva vow, they're not empowerments. Yeah, you were aware of that, but I just want everybody else to be clear of that. Okay. In the Tibetan tradition, there are a variety of ways in which people can express their commitment, take on commitment to their path. One of the big ones, of course, is monastic ordination. Cousin to that is ordination as a lay person, where you take on certain moral commitments. The Bodhisattva vow is a formal ceremony where you adopt the intention to work for the welfare of beings through becoming awake yourself. The great empowerments involve commitments of a very different sort. In Vajrayana, they're basically a commitment to experience the world a certain way, so they're very, very difficult. And then there are additional ones such as the vow of refuge, which in Tibetan Buddhism is actually very comparable to baptism in Christianity. It's where you entered the Buddhist way formally. And yes, it's a commitment. When Rinpoche asked me to teach, he directed me to teach, I wouldn't say he asked, actually. He also gave me authority to do any form of transmission that I felt was necessary. So I've given vows of refuge and Bodhisattva vows, and occasionally empowerments and other things to a few students here and there, not very, very much. I chose a very long time ago not to do things on a public level, because Vajrayana was never meant to be practiced on a public level, so I just decided, let's just forget that. More recently, and this really goes back to about a year ago, I've taken a very, very hard look at where I am with all of those things. And while I see them as very, very helpful and important aspects of some people's practice, where the act of making a commitment and then adhering to that commitment becomes a tool for their own practice. On a personal level, I've decided that that isn't a way that I want to work with students anymore. So I'm not doing that anymore. And I've got a few people saying, well, we're just going to wait and see about that, Ken. So, but that's where I'm at right now. Okay, does that answer your question?
Okay.
Okay. Bill, then George.
Two questions. The first is, in the essence of the Dharma, I don't see Nundro. And it's not that I miss it, but I've been some places.
You don't miss it?
where it's made a very big deal of, and I'm kind of surprising not to see it in Kala Rinpoche. So I'm wondering if he didn't think it was belonged in the essence. Well, but if you want to skip that, that's fine.
No, it's just so ironic.
The other question is, you described refuge as direction and the bodhisattva vow as intention.
Yes.
And I'm not 100% sure what the distinction would be.
Oh, okay. Let's take that last one first. Just to use, I'll just continue with the metaphor, really. Say I want to go to Denver, and from here, and I'm going to walk. Okay, so it's a good long way. Well, every morning when I wake up, I've got to make sure I'm facing north, direction. Then I have to start walking, intention. Okay? You're allowed to follow up.
I guess I would put that as a direction is a overall orientation towards,
yes,
a goal that's sort of epitomized in a way that there are no details.
Okay.
And intention would be...
I'm going to go there.
Yeah, and the actual steps that I need to take, mm-hmm, after I've turned, yeah, in that direction.
Yeah. Nundro. The reason I laughed is that when I first met Rinpoche in 1970, I was completely incapable of meditation. I mean, I couldn't sit for a minute, was pushing it. 30 seconds, that was, it was impossible. Rinpoche, one of the ways that Rinpoche worked is that he relied on what we would call portents. Portents. P-O-R-T-E-N-T-S. Portents. So, when he met somebody or somebody came and said they wanted to help him, he would give them a task. And if they completed the task, then he would trust them. But if circumstances conspired, trains fell off bridges or roads were washed out, kinds of things that happened in India all the time. And so they weren't able to complete the task for whatever reason. Then he wouldn't. It was a portent. And so he didn't care whether they were particularly bright or capable or whatever. Did the task happen or not? And so, as one of my colleagues pointed out to me many years later, I couldn't meditate at all. And I heard about this practice of Nundro. At this point, Rinpoche had given up giving Westerners Nundro because nobody did them. And so he gave me and my wife the practice after... We had to ask several times before he agreed. And then we had to translate it because it was in Tibetan. There weren't any translations around in those days. And so we translated it ourselves, and then we did it. And ever after, Rinpoche said, told all his students to learn Tibetan and do Nundro. So, he regarded it as very important. And in classical setting, it's a very powerful practice because it's exactly what it says. It's a foundation. And when you do mandrel, you feel like you have set out bricks. And they're in the ground. And now you've got something you can stand on. Of course, some of us are a little slower than others, so I actually ended up doing it several times because I had a lot of stuff to work through. But when Rinpoche is talking about the essence of the Dharma, well, there are many essences of the Dharma. These Dogen, what's it called? The Shobo Genzo or something. It's a little bit longer than this. It's a page and a half. And it's Dogen's summary of what's essential.
Genjo Koan, I think.
That's the one. Thank you. The Genjo Koan. And many teachers at one time or another, after many years of practice, they say, this is what's important. And it's wonderful, because everybody views it and said, that's very nice, and pays no attention to it. Because they've heard about all this other stuff, and think, oh, this is really important, that's really important, this is important. And so they practice for 30, 40, 50 years, and then they write something, and they write exactly the same thing. Because it is actually what's important. So, Ngundro, or how I like to translate it, is groundwork. Yeah, very important. Establishing motivation, preparing you in a lot of different ways for a different approach to practice, or a different. It's building a lot of capability which you don't use at that point, but then become available to you later on in your practice. But is it essential in the same way that this, what Rinpoche is writing here is? No, it's the essence of practice is very simple. I actually like to reduce it to one line. How can I experience this and be at peace at the same time?
That's great.
Okay, George.
Niguma's image, graces the cover of the Trackless Path, which is the booklet that we've been using on this retreat. And I wonder if you could go through the symbolism of the image, what's in her hands, and not just what the meaning of it is, but perhaps what significance it has for this retreat.
I like the image.
I do too.
Now, this is painted by a friend of mine, Sungjae Elliott, who's a very skilled artist, as you can see. And he gave us permission to use this and a couple of other of his illustrations. Nyingma here is shown as a slightly wrathful Dakini in the form of a female sadhu. You can almost think of her like a Buddhist version of a Shivite sadhu. I don't know what the feminine for sadhu is. The staff that you see there is the Buddhist version of Shiva's trident, and represents her consort. So the union of means and wisdom. the Damaru, that's the hand drum that she has in her right hand, would symbolize means and any number of different meanings could be attached to this, but one of them would be the sound of emptiness. Another would be command of that level of energy I was talking about in terms of protector, Dakini, all of that kind of stuff. She holds in her left hand a skull cup filled with elixir. So, from the emptiness of self, she drinks everything, the richness of experience. So, she sits on a pelt, which would symbolize, usually would indicate any relationship with compassion, and so forth. So, no particular significance for this retreat. You can associate this whatever you want.
Are the three heads on the trident aversion, attraction,
indifference,
and dullness?
Yeah, that's right.
And it symbolizes the victory or independence from those three directions?
Yeah, they're done.
They're done. Does the blue mean anything? The color, the choice of blue?
Could. I mean, it would be like sky. But that may be reading too much into it.
And the color of her body?
Dark brown. Various interpretations could be given of that, but I haven't heard any particular one. Okay. Other questions? Nothing else. Robert.
Going back to the discussion about Nundro, I went through the whole Nundro process many years ago as part of my process with my teacher at that time. And I really feel that I barely understood what I was doing. I've continued to practice, and I certainly have continue to have a tremendous commitment to practice. So I'm curious about your perspective of the role of actually understanding what you're doing in the Nundro in terms of laying that foundation that you described.
I think it's quite important. Like you, the first time I did Nundro, pretty hazy idea of what it meant. Some of it was clear, some of it was much not at all clear, such as mandala particularly. So I did it again when I had a better understanding. So that's always a possibility. Because understanding's cheap and doesn't do much. I mean, we're all intelligent, most of us have college educations. Understanding's the snap for us. and it doesn't change much. So if you really want to if you want to change, then you got to do. Just understanding doesn't serve the purpose. So you know, whether you do Mundo or another form of practice, it's primarily about doing. That's far more important. Okay. Anything else? Helen, Robert, could you pass the mic back, please? 1 second.
I just want to clarify what I thought I heard you say, that you thought it was not necessarily essential, although it lays the groundwork.
Yeah, it's very, very helpful. We're talking about a certain practice which in Tibetan is called Ngundro,
right.
Which I translate as groundwork. Most people translate as preparatory practices. And it's become, very unfortunately, this thing that people do so they can get the good stuff, which is a completely ridiculous way of approaching it. One of my teachers, Dejing Rinpoche, his teacher, Ngawang Lepa, was a highly regarded scholar and a very important administrator of a bunch of monastic estates. And he's first basically 20 years of his monastic life, he spent most of the time traveling by yak from one monastery to another, taking care of affairs and business. These were big estates, and there was a lot of economic, political, and practical considerations to be addressed. Now, yak travel isn't the most comfortable or the fastest form of travel in the world. So, while he was traveling, he constantly read Milarepa's biography and the 100,000 songs. So just read that while he was traveling. And then at the age of 39, he said, you know, this is just garbage. And he gave up all of his responsibilities and his status in the monastic establishment and went to live in a cave above the monastery, or the, one of the main monasteries he was used to be responsible for. He then did 4,400,000 prostrations, 2,100,000 mandala offering, vajrasattvas, 5,500,000 mandala offerings, and no record of how much guru yoga. In other words, he did the practices. He didn't do them as something that you did to get the good stuff. He just did the practices. And that's really what it's about. You know, some students have studied with me in Ngundro. I don't let them count. You know, they just do the practice. That's it. And I meet with them periodically, see how they're doing, and see what they're understanding or coming to know, more than understand, what they're coming to know through the practice. And at a certain point I say, okay, go on to the next one. But there's no counting, because I just think it takes people in the wrong direction.
But is yogi counting?
That's what he did. You know, but also he did a few more than most people do.
But if he didn't count, who would know?
What's your point, Larry?
Well,
microphone.
I'm kind of split on it. I mean, counting is a way of kind of keeping one focused.
Okay.
On the other hand, if you don't count, because there are quite a few preliminary practices to do, you know, and there's probably nothing wrong with this. One could do Vajrasattva, 100-syllable Vajrasattva forever.
Yep.
I mean, forget everything else. I'm just saying that it's just kind of a way of parceling time. And
yes, but one needs to focus on why one is practicing. That's why the first question I asked all of you to consider is, why are you here? So that you don't get caught up with all of this other stuff, which is all just aspects of the institutionalization of these practices. You know, and it's why in this retreat particularly, I'm not presenting a particular practice. I'm not presenting a particular path. I'm encouraging each of you to find your path. Long Lekpa's path was to go and practice this way. And probably he counted just to keep his mind focused, but he was not concerned with, he wasn't at all concerned with completing a certain number. He was only concerned with doing the practice, and that was his path. And that's a very powerful way to practice. Yeah. So that's why I'm in this retreat doing what I can to help you find your path, and then you pour whatever energy you are capable of into it. And as I was saying to Robert a few moments ago, understanding's cheap. It's not worth much. What changes things is doing these practices, because whether you look at it physiologically, neurologically, emotionally, psychology, things come about when you step out of the conceptual mind and you start working directly with the body and your experience, and you do things in a different way, then something changes, things like that. But as long as we're trying to understand practices and things like that, nothing changes. Yeah. Helen, and then Judy. Yes.
Well, I really appreciate what you're saying here, because I have not done Nundro, but I know that sometimes in our center there's a lot of emphasis on doing so many and then going on to the next step and so on. And it's kind of bothered me, but I also realize that, well, if there are four different aspects of your body, for example, one's whole body, one's mental, one's voice, speech, and so on, that maybe one of those could particularly help you focus more than, say, the other practice. And maybe that awareness practice that attention could help you connect better or something. I don't know, to be more focused or whatever. But
well, people work in different ways. Some people, I mean, our retreat director, Mahamudra was his practice. And
sorry, who?
Our retreat director when I was in the 3-year retreat, mm-hmm. Lama Temba. Mahamudra was his practice. He didn't do anything else. And he'd come over to the retreat sometimes. He said, you know, I really should offer a few tormas to Mahakala. Oh, I'm too lazy. and by lazy, he meant that he sat, you know, about 20 hours a day. And he slept for about 4 hours sitting up. So, very lazy person. And, you know, and in the second retreat, he didn't teach the four immeasurables at all. And I worked with him when he got to taking and sending. Actually, he didn't even teach taking and sending, just a very little bit. He had been doing something else. I had a really knock-down, drag-em-out argument with him about that, because it had been a really important part of my training in the first retreat. And finally, after listening to me, you know, basically yell at him for half an hour, he just looked at me and said, Ken, that worked for you. It doesn't work for me. You know, Mahamudra really, really worked for him. And Four Immeasurables was a very important part of my own practice, which is one of the reasons I teach it, because I think it's very, very important. So other people, it's like Avalokiteshvara. Other people, it is resting with the breath. There are many, many practices, and the important thing is to find a way of practice that speaks to you. That's really what I hope you can move in that direction. And then it doesn't matter what anybody else is doing, because you have something which speaks to you and brings about change in you when you do it. And that's what's really, really important. Once you get into a center institutional thing and people are doing this practice and this practice, you get into this comparison game, who's getting ahead of whom, etc., etc. And one of my students at a retreat many years ago, it was an insight retreat, I gave them a couple of options. One was to do the traditional insight practices, and the other one was to work with Nasruddin stories. So and she's a pretty good practitioner, so she was working on her third Nasruddin story in this particular retreat. At the end of the retreat, she said, "How many other people got to three?" And I said, "You're never going to know." Because it was the comparison game again. And this stuff comes up all the time. And it's really, it's worse than useless. It's counterproductive. It works in the wrong direction. And so to the extent that it's possible in trying to create a way of practice. I mean, none of you, at least at this point, I don't feel any of you are in competition with anybody else. No. But, you know, there are a lot of other places. That's the kind of stuff's going on, and it's just not helpful. Okay. There's some other questions somewhere. Who was it? Leslie, and then Judy.
Could it possibly be a myth that he did that number?
I don't think so. I mean, Dajun Rinpoche wasn't like that. No, I mean, when you think about it, it's just extraordinary. But that's that's just what he did. And Dajun Rinpoche, I'll tell you, like, and Dajun Rinpoche was very, very close to Noong Lepa. And so, one time Dajun Rinpoche was telling us, you know, Noong Lepa would be sitting in his cave, look down at the lights of the monastery and go, "Oh, I really wish I was where it was nice and warm instead of sitting in this cold, dark cave." You know, so I don't think it was a myth at all. The it was, you know, that's what he did. And it's that level of dedication, and not only dedication, but that level of longing. I mean, there are a number of different topics which come in here, which I don't think I have time tonight to talk about all of them, but at least just touch on them a little bit. I just said, you know, this comparison game is really unfortunate. In the Theravadan tradition, you don't drop the comparison game until you're a full-fledged arhat. In the Mahayana tradition, you don't drop the comparison game until it's like 8th or 9th level bodhisattva. Like, it's really, really deep in us. So we hear stories such as the one I've told about Noong Lekpa, and immediately we start comparing ourselves, right? It's the wrong way to rate, I think it's the wrong way to relate to the story. I think a better way is what I was saying a few moments ago. When you hear about that, you have a visceral feeling for this person's devotion and commitment. And that moves something in us. It actually, I think, potentially awakens something in us. One facet of the spiritual path that I think is very, very important is it has to be volitional. Now, volitional. When you get in an institutional setting, it becomes, there are many facets which make it subtly or explicitly coercive. One of the reasons I'm emphasizing resting here rather than making an effort. You can't force anybody to rest. It's impossible. You can force people to make an effort, but then you do things to the person that are not so good. And there's a lot of that that goes on. But you cannot force someone to rest. And when someone rests deeply, as you, several of you saw in the first night you were here with Pat and Kristen giving their presentations, really powerful things happened. They happened in a different way. You can listen to this story about Ngawang Lepa as this is how he rested. You know, and this, you go, what? No, he was doing prostration, he was doing work, all of this stuff. No, this is how he rested. The outpouring of that kind of energy is what allowed him to rest completely in the practice. Mm-hmm. And he was, you know, quite a remarkable person. So I think we need to hear these things and approach them in a good way, not a way which A, makes us feel bad, B, arouses our competitive thing, because that's a shortcut to insanity. And I know that from fact. There were a couple of women who heard that my wife and I had done Gundro X number of times. So they decided they had to do that too. Well, both of them went crazy in the 3-year retreat. Mm. Wasn't a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
what?
Went crazy. It was very sad. Because they were driven by the wrong motivation. Mm. And in working with you, and I think most of you know this by now, I really have eagle eyes out for counterproductive motivations. And then I jump all over you. Mm. When that stuff comes up, because it can be really, really destructive. Mm-hmm. And I've seen too much of it. Anything you want to follow up on that, Leslie?
A different topic, I wanted to say that I think the reason that I feel there's very little comparison going on is because you treat people very equally. Mm-hmm. So that produces a certain atmosphere.
Yeah, well, thank you. Okay. Judy, you had a question.
Well, I've been thinking about what you said about the Chenrezig practice and, you know, interpreting it into, like, life situations. And I've been really just digesting it, I guess. I did that practice that you're describing when I was much younger, and just remember, you know, trying to do Tibetan and read the English at the same time, do the visualization, do the mantra, and, you know, none of that quality, I mean, actually, it got boring after a while because there wasn't that sort of essence in the belly to really get motivated by. And so I guess my question is, when you were saying, you know, understanding is cheap, it feels like approaching it from that angle does bring in a certain kind of understanding that doesn't seem cheap, but really grabs you to go further.
Yes, but I'm not calling that understanding. Okay. I'm calling that knowing. Just understanding how a practice works, what it does. This is cheap.
Okay.
And it doesn't do anything. But when you, as you say, take, okay, what does compassion, what does the waking compassion mean in this situation? Now you've got to work. You know, because you've got stuff pulling you in this way and stuff pulling you in this way and stuff pulling in that way all over the place. And so you've got to work, and you end up forming different relationships with all of that internal material, and then actually translating that into action in the world. That changes things.
It's very alive.
Yeah.
It's not a theory of any kind, or even, you know, a set of A, B, C.
No, and there's no formula, because you give two people the same situation, but because they're two different people, awakened compassion is going to look different in those two situations.
I'm going to sit on that one longer. I have another question, though, also. At the end where it says, continually pray to your guru, is that sort of a referring of just getting to a point where you're just in a sense connection with the guru all the time, or is that referring to something very specific?
Both. There are different forms of prayer, and one form is, as you'll find a couple of examples on bottom of page 22, top of page 23 are two forms of prayer, which are, the first one's used in the Shangpa tradition, the second one's used in the Kagyu tradition, and these are actual prayers. And you can shorten it down to the Tibetan expression Lama Cheno, which basically means Guru, think of me. And there are people who just recite that. That's their prayer. Virtually becomes a mantra. And then there's another form of prayer, and these aren't mutually exclusive at all, in which you continually feel the presence of your teacher in your life. That can be cultivated in a number of different ways. One of the traditional ways is to imagine the guru on your head. That goes way back to India. Another is to imagine the guru in your heart. And that it's a practice, and you do this. Or you just have that sense of your teacher's presence in your life, and you're very deliberately cultivating that. And you can say, well, this is artificial and contrived, etc., etc. That's all true. But when you put this kind of energy into it, you're changing your internal environment. You're introducing this element, and you're actually changing what you're working with, what's going on in your experience. And when that becomes sufficiently deeply embedded, it starts translating into a different way of experiencing the world. So, and these are methods, but, and they do produce results. Does that help?
Thank you.
Okay. Let's stop here. We have time for a short meditation. And we'll return to ever-present good tomorrow evening. I want to touch base with you and figure out any other questions.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.